When I started making music when I was like 7, I wanted to be the next Britney Spears. So I'm not where I wanted to be, but I figured out along the way that I didn't want to be there, which was really important. And if I had got that life, I don't think I would be happy.
Hannah Trigwell, singer-songwriter. She sent over 175 million views across her YouTube channel, videos and live versions of both original songs and covers. You mentioned the life that you want to have.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
I always wanted to have...
So start with, can you tell us, what age did you begin singing? Did you take lessons? Were you self-taught?
I'm self-taught.
100%?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
I wanted lessons, but I also wanted lessons in a lot of other things.
Right.
So I think when I was younger, it was a case of, what do you want to do most? Let's do that. So I played football for a long time, really loved that, did a lot of other sporty things, netball, hockey, yeah, that kind of thing. But no singing lessons. So I think I got into singing very young, and my mum says that I used to go around on my tricycle singing the Disney songs from the films and stuff like that. But then when I went to high school, because I did some performances at like primary school galas and assemblies and stuff like that, and my friends in behind me doing interpretive backing dancing
right.
with little tutus on when we were like 8 years old. But then when I went to high school, I think I just lost all my confidence regarding that and didn't sing again publicly for 7 years, maybe
Whoa,
8 years.
Really?
Yeah. But was kind of learning in the background in my bedroom,
okay.
watching videos, that kind of thing.
And have you ever thought back to what happened in those kind of intervening years? What?
I think I was just not shy teenager, but I think I was very concerned with how everyone else perceived me.
Yeah.
And still was really, like, through my 20s a bit, but definitely when I was a teenager was just, I really wanted other people to think that I was a good singer, and I didn't know if I was yet because I was still learning and trying to do it. So I was, I was more confident in the kind of sport and science area during high school.
Interesting, because I know at that age, like they say, and I've got two teenage daughters, and they say at that age a lot of girls start dropping sports, and other stuff. And I'm like, with mine, it's like, if you drop in that, you need to do something else. That kind of thing, you know.
So I played football for a long time, and then I went more into music towards the end of high school, but privately. So I would be, instead of out in the playground during breaks, in a music room by myself, hoping that a teacher didn't come and kick me out, trying to play guitar but not playing very well. And yeah, that was a lot of my final year of high school was like that.
And when did you first pick up a guitar then? If you started singing first and the guitar came later.
So the guitar, my sister started trying to learn to play and I was really jealous and I took it off.
You took it off her?
Yeah, so my older sister was starting to learn to play and I thought it looked really cool. I think we're about 13, maybe. She's about a year older than me. And I just, kind of was like, I want to do that. Sibling rivalry kind of thing, maybe. So it was the guitar that my dad's dad left him.
Right.
So we only had one guitar in the house, and it was like an old classical Spanish, really... like well used thing, so it was either I was playing it or she was, and I think I won that fight.
And where did that inspiration come from? Was it literally just seeing a guitar that your sister had and you're like, mine, or was there people that you'd heard, seen, that kind of inspired you to pick up a guitar?
So a lot of music was played around the house, different genres of music. My mum really liked Motown and my dad was more into things like the Eagles and stuff like that. And Jamiroquai. And so, like, there was a lot of music around the house, and I wanted to make that sort of thing. And then I remember when my dad had the first Norah Jones album on repeat, and I just felt like it was so beautiful, and it really emotionally affected me when I was like a young teenager, and I wanted to make something that made other people feel something or feel like that in some way. And a lot of that album, at least for the beginning of the songs, start with like a stripped back acoustic singer-songwriter kind of vibe. And so I saw myself a bit in what she was doing, or wanted to do that kind of thing.
Interesting. And is that like reflecting back when you said you're like an early teenager, or were you aware at the time that you wanted to affect people in that certain kind of way as well? Because it's quite emotionally intelligent thing to...
Maybe. Well, yeah. I just felt like so emotionally affected by this music. Like, I would listen to like a Celine Dion album and just cry. Like, obviously,
in a good way or a bad way?
There's a lot of hormones going on.
Yeah, I can relate to that moment.
When you're a teenager, but I felt like it was so magic to listen to music, and it made me feel like I was in a movie. Like, it was such I can't really describe the feeling, but I felt like it would be incredible to have made that music and people be able to emotionally connect with it in that kind of way.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. And how did you go from having that gap between performing to then busking on the streets of your hometown? Where did you get the confidence and the goal to do that? How did that come about?
There was a busker in Leeds, I think he's based in London now, called Tristan Mackay, who was amazing, really amazing. Whenever we used to go shopping with my parents in Leeds on weekend, we would see him and be like, wow. And this was maybe, I started seeing him first perform when I was 14, I think. And which kind of was around the similar time that I tried to start making music that sounded a bit like Norah Jones, singer-songwritery vibe. But I only ever, I mean, this was 18 years ago. So I, at that time, you never saw female buskers anywhere. No. And you didn't really see buskers under the age of like 30, even 20, over the age of 30. No, is that what I mean? Yeah, you didn't see buskers under the age of 30, sorry. So it was mostly older men. It wasn't really on my radar, really, to start busking. But then I got a bit of a rapport going with Tristan. Just every time I'd go out when I was about 17, I'd see him busking and have a little chat and give him some money or buy a CD or whatever. Yeah. And then I did a few shifts at my local Toby Carvery. I'm sorry, Toby Carvery. and it wasn't good. and I was like, right, I'm just going to try it. He seems to be doing quite well from busking. This is pre-recession. I don't know whether it's different now, but I was like, I'm just going to try it. Let's just give it a go. And so my first busking session, I got this really bad quality tiny amp that was powered by like six huge batteries, and I played so you might have to cut that out. My first busking session was when I went up to a busker. It wasn't Tristan, it was somebody else called Dave, and I said, can I have a go? And he was like, no, obviously. I'd be like, no, some way. Random person coming to hold my guitar that I've, and spit into my microphone. So he was like, no. And then I went around and then I came back and said, please, can I have a go? And he said, yeah. And then I played a song, Tracy Chapman, Fast Car. And a little crowd started forming and people throwing money in. And I was like, I'm never waitressing ever again. I hate it so much. Wow. I'm going to try and do this and make this a thing. So I started busking quite regularly when I was 18, 19. Mm-hmm. Took a year out between college and uni to just busk, and it was great. And so I was out like 5 times a week, just busking. Yeah.
So Toby Carvery's loss.
Toby Carvery's loss.
Music industry's gain.
There were some things about Toby Carvery that I quite like, but a lot of, the management at the time was not great.
Yeah. And that was the first song that you played, Tracy Chapman's
Fire. Yeah.
I heard that song on the radio driving here this morning.
Did you?
Yeah.
It's meant to be.
It is meant to be. That's quite random, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow, interesting. And was that part of the plan? You made a conscious decision to take a year out before you went to uni to busk?
Yeah, so I felt like I needed to, if I was going to go to uni, I needed to do the thing that I was best at academically. Mm. And I was really conscious that I didn't want to turn music into this thing that I had to do, like a chore. So I persuaded my parents to let me defer a year. Because
I was about to say, how did that conversation go?
It was a few conversations. And again, not sure how it works right now, but at that time you could get your place and then just pause it, kind of thing, for a year. And then once I started busking and it was going so well, and I also started doing a bit of touring during that time, then as my uni start date approached, I was just dreading it, really. Mm. And so I did go through uni and got my degree and everything, but it was hard. And like every other week I was saying, I don't want
really?
To be here. Because my mind was just somewhere else. And so I did biology, and even though I really enjoyed that, I was just not in it like you should be when you study.
That was like a 3-year degree.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and so over the course of those 3 years, there was a lot of international touring, a lot of music releases, and it was very stressful to get, I wanted to get a good grade in my coursework and my finals at the same time as being, in a van, studying and then playing a show. It was mental, really.
Wow. Those conversations with your parents, you obviously won those conversations.
My dad said you can't fly with one foot on the floor, so it was kind of like, be all in it for a year, see how it goes. If it becomes something in that year that is viable to carry on with, then keep going. But it didn't quite get there, so by the time I finished uni, I came out and it was my full-time career at that time. But I wasn't fully ready to dive in at the end of my gap year. So,
okay. So, you finished uni.
Yep.
Okay. You've taken a year out beforehand and you've been touring whilst trying to balance biology degree. What was the vision at that point? Had you formulated a vision in your mind? You were saying that you had kind of really, it was almost set out then that you're going to go into music as a career. What were the other options at that point, like through biology, for example?
I didn't specialise in anything, so it was general biology, but I always wanted to go into something that was environmental, like ecology kind of... how to have a green environment, should we say, and like renewable energy resources and things like that. My dissertation was on renewable energy resources and kind of interlinked with some GMO stuff, but I guess I don't know what the role would have been, but something around renewable energy.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was what had been formulating in your mind then with the vision for music? Where did you see yourself going? Was there a plan? Was there, 3, 5, 10-year plan? This is where I see myself, and this is how I reverse engineer getting to Norah Jones level.
That would have been really clever. No,
it really is. But
I don't think that my brain was wired that way at that time. I think I was just like, I love making music. I just want to make music. Can I feasibly do this as a career? And then, the older I've got and the more of a plan there is. But yeah, I think I was just winging it, to be honest. I knew what kind of set me on fire, and I knew that I, because of doing biology as well, I knew that if I tried to do something else, I'd always be veering over here mentally and not be able to give my 100% into something that wasn't music, basically. So.
And what what set you on fire about it specifically? Was it performing live? Was it writing a song?
It started with performing live, but it became writing a song because I felt like it was, that's where the creative or like the artistry for me comes out. I think when I'm performing, it's more of a like, here's what I've done, here's what I made.
Yeah.
But when I'm making the thing, that feels extremely productive for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And in your experience, is it the people you've worked with, you've toured with, does it differ between different artists quite a lot of people? Because you read a lot of people, it's like the live aspect that is what lights them up. It's not the process.
I think, I'm not sure actually. I think some artists keep it really close to the chest because there's almost a bit of a stigma around, you know, like if you know that Michael Jackson interview where they're like, oh, do you like touring? And he's like, no.
It
kills me. I hate it.
Yeah.
You're not really supposed to say stuff like that, obviously, because you want people to enjoy the concert and you want to sell tickets. And so I haven't asked anyone that I've toured with, but to be fair, everyone that I've toured with has really enjoyed performing live, and I have as well, but I probably enjoy writing a bit more. But yeah, I think the one thing I have noticed is that everyone I've toured with has been, especially if I'm supporting, the ones that I've supported have been like so at home on stage, almost like they come into themselves, or there's like a bit of a Sasha Fierce moment going on where they're just a person backstage, and then they get on and they're like, boom.
Yeah.
Like,
this is different personality. Yeah.
Which is really interesting to see and something that I can't do. I'm just like, hi guys. Yeah.
Interesting. And what's the vision now for you, like here today, 2023, heading into the second part of the year?
Yeah, it's a bit different now. I think I'm a bit more focused on long term and a plan and things like that. So I've been writing a book about how to create a sustainable career in music, because I think it's quite hard to do unless you have a plan. And my plan kind of got figured out all along the way, but there's a lot of things that I'm wanting to just lay out in the book, which is maybe a shortcut or just a here's like multiple different revenue streams that you can start working on, which don't take away from your artistry and that kind of thing. And then the digital marketing agency is taking up a lot of my time. And I really love that because it's all the things that I've always done for myself, like video production and SEO and brand stuff and artwork and paid ads and blogs and all this kind of stuff. But it's not reliant on my face.
Okay.
Which is like, it might sound really weird, but it's nice to not have to be like, hey, it's me again. Where I can be creative but kind of on someone else's behalf. I'm really getting a lot of fulfillment out of that at the moment. And then my album finishing, that's been a really big project. So I had a single coming out every 6 weeks, and that's coming to a close now, and that's been great and really fulfilling to do after COVID lockdown stuff, because I did a lot of things that were related to music but not music during that time because I couldn't get into studios and all this stuff. So
yeah. And with that vision, did that evolve from being in your bedroom, from busking those years, touring at uni, or purely the love of music and the process?
I think it was a bit of everything, really. I started to teach music business in 2017, I think it was, at Leeds Conservatoire, which was Leeds College of Music. So at degree level, and I really loved doing that, and that was a course called Emerging Music Models. And as I was doing my own research around that and also doing my artist thing and staying independent, it helped me to get my ideas together for the book and the Backstage Pass podcast that I did with Tom. And and then after doing that and starting to do some digital marketing bits for different people and different artists, I was like, well, it just makes sense to make that a thing as well. Yeah. But I'm also, you know, at a stage in my career where I'm thinking about how to make what I've done so far sustainable. So where I've done different things and thought about different streams of revenue before, it's been like, oh, I'm going to have a Patreon and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. But I'm not sure if I'm going to want to tour when I'm 50. Yeah. I'm just not sure. So I'm like, what can I do now that's going to create the life that I want and keep this creativity and keep being involved in making music and helping other people do that? And so that's why I'm doing these different bits now.
What do you think of when you see a Dolly Parton or a Rolling Stones on stage at Glastonbury in like 70s, 80 even, like Mick Jagger was 80 last week or something? What pops into your head when you see that?
I just think it's great. Yeah. I love it. And I love it that they're really enjoying it as well. And, you know, it's probably easy to enjoy something like that if you're a massive superstar as well, you know. So
yeah, like the ease with which you must get transported around and the five-star life.
It's not like that when you're independent, but I mean, so they get to do that and be that, whereas on the independent side, or certainly for me, I've had to be everything. So, you know, the tour manager, the soundie, the roadie, after a tour my arms are absolutely ripped because it's just me carrying all my stuff everywhere. I think I'm not entirely sure, but I do have some kind of, I think that there's not going to be those kind of iconic people at that age doing things like that in 30 years. Because the people who are getting traction with songs or albums right now, the artists just seem to be having shorter career lifespans. So I'm not sure how it would. There's only a few artists that come to mind where I'm like, oh yeah, they might, you know, play Glastonbury in 30 years and people would still go and love it. But yeah, it's sort of like, there's been a lot of talk of like the death of the icon with the faster turnover of singles and artists and all that kind of thing. So
it's interesting because there's a couple of things. Like, I think a positive is like when I hear like the music coming from my daughter's rooms, it's like 90s music, and you think, why are you listening to 90s music? Where does that come from? And it's like things like platforms like Spotify, you'll listen to something and it will suggest other stuff. Or there's like Stranger Things, and they're getting to Kate Bush, and you're like, "Wow, this is great," but then you also think there's so much more choice, and you think, "How do you stay like, especially from a band's perspective, how do you stay together for that long, like the Rolling Stones or somebody?
Hard.
Like, it must be hard." You mentioned the life that you want to have.
Yeah,
what does that look like? Are you good at like envisioning things?
In terms of like legit, my brain's very like logic if you asked me to design a kitchen, it would be really bad. But the logic of like where the sink should be, and you
right,
know,
okay.
That's how my brain kind of works. So I guess I always wanted to have a family alongside music. So that was kind of a focus at the same time as building music, and now that I have that, I want to be around. So then that there has to be a shift a little bit with music when that happens. Mm. And so I've kind of, because some artists are so like focused on this career path, and this is what I want to do, and I want to get to this level. But I kind of have two things going on in my head at the same time, which needed to adapt to each other. And that was, I want to have my own family, but also be around and be spending time and making memories with my family, my mum and dad and my sister and my friends. Yeah. But I also want to do music. So yeah. Doing most of my music online and doing the videos and doing the podcast and all that kind of thing has worked really well for me. Mm. I don't think it would work well for everybody. No. But that is the reason why I've done it the way that I've done it kind of okay. thing. And yeah, so my future vision, I guess, is being able to do music and travel and possibly touring and all this kind of thing, but in a way that I've got a home.
Yeah.
And I've got like a place that I'm not just going in between tours, that I'm like there for like quality amounts of time, you know?
No, I get that. And on the way up, I was listening to podcast with Will I Am, and he was right. saying like, and I think he must be coming up to 50, something like that.
Is he?
Yeah, like late 40s.
I just think of him as like 27.
I know. Like when he said, it's only now that I feel I want to have kids, I want to be a father, but I've never been able to put my head in that headspace, because he said between 1998 and last year, I've never been anywhere for longer than 8 weeks. And it was just like, what?
Yeah.
And it's like, how can you devote that time to, you know, nurturing your
kids?
Yeah,
you can't. You can't.
Crazy life.
Yeah, it is. It is. And some people really make it work. Mm. But most of those people that are able to make it work at his level have like three nannies, you know,
yeah,
and they're like absolute rock stars. And I'm just, I think I've got like a vision of where I want to be, but it definitely involves having like a home that is like a family home and being around, and but also being creative and making stuff happen. So,
and that includes like the agency and that being an author.
Yeah, the agency, being an author, but also still making music.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of covers that I want to do still that haven't ticked off my list, where I'm like, God, that's just such a great song and I could do it in this really stripped back way. And
people will keep making music that you want to do covers for, of course.
Well, hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah.
I mean, it's weird because I used to play at weddings a lot, and still now, you know, I went to a wedding... my best friend got married this weekend in Slovenia, and all the bands and the musicians are still playing the songs from between 2010 to 2018. There's not really anything, there's maybe like one new song in there, if that, and it's just a trend thing, and maybe they won't play it next year. And it's just such an interesting time for music, I think.
Mm. Love Slovenia. I went there last year, snowboarding.
Oh, really?
Yeah, beautiful country.
Yeah, really beautiful.
Do you have any doubts that you won't succeed?
No.
Love that.
No, but...
Because I love the diversification that you got.
Yeah.
And is there anybody that you see already doing that and you're like, that's what I want to have? Or do you think you're really forging kind of a new path, really, for somebody in the industry that you started out in?
I don't think I've ever seen really anyone that I've been like, that's me, or that's where I kind of heard myself in a bit in Norah Jones. But yeah, there's not really been anyone where I'm like, oh, I really want to be like them as a as an artist, or I really want to be like them as a business person, or as a human, really.
Okay.
There's a lot of things, individual things that you could take from different people. But yeah, I'm not sure. I think the like several streams of income thing has only really come to the fore, like been a conversation point in the last like 5, maybe 10 at a push years.
Okay.
So this kind of like portfolio career to have in music or in a creative industry is maybe a new or an, yeah, like a less traditional way of doing things. So maybe that's why I haven't seen it. Or being able to like base my career off somebody else's, but I don't know how else I would do it now. This is I'm just like I like to be across multiple things and weigh them up and like if it's not working, pivot and just you know
yeah.
I read a lot of business books and that fires me up. Like all my friends reading like these cool like. Sex in the City vibe novels and I'm just like you know how can I, what's like the leanest way to build a startup and
yeah
know?
The lean starter yeah, yeah. Who do you look to for inspiration from business perspective and like growing an agency?
Well, I really like that book by Eric Ries, is it?
Yeah.
Rice.
I don't know how you pronounce it. R-E-I-S.
Yeah, the Lean Startup.
Yeah,
I love that. I mean, you've had Stephen Bartlett on this podcast before,
yeah.
And he's obviously doing great things. It's hard to say, really. I read a lot of business books. I was obsessed with Gary Vee for a while.
Yeah, I think we all been through that kind of stage.
Yeah.
And then you're like, actually... And I think he's come full circle with it, you know, that whole thing that you need to be putting out 1,000 pieces of content a week and you need to be working 24/7 and that whole burnout thing is just like, it just doesn't work for anybody.
Yeah, if you've got a team to do it or, you know, the max that you can do within your own capacity that you won't burn out, then great. I do think the more, well, as long as it's kind of refined in at least a little bit, the more content you can put out, the better. I mean, it worked for my YouTube channel. We were putting out a cover a week, every week, for like 3 years. And it didn't do a lot until... I think I'd been posting covers on for like 2.5 years and then suddenly just all started to compound. And so, yeah, but it's impossible just as one person to put out 100 pieces of content a day. I mean,
yeah. Tell me a little bit about the YouTube channel there. And that was a cover a week, you say 3 years.
Yeah.
And
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit how that went because I'm with you on that, and it was very much the same with my podcast. It was literally just like, and also that I took it more seriously, and I set a goal. Right, I'm going to get this to number one in the UK, and then within 6 months, we'd done that, and then by the end of 12 months, it was number one in like 10 countries. But to get to that point, like the first week, 2 downloads. You know, 2 years later, it's still kind of like not flatlining, but not much growth, and then. Again, it's just like showing up every week, putting something out, even when sometimes you don't feel like doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's hard. That's really hard. Especially when it involves your face, because you have to be kind of on.
Mm.
And it's easier when you love doing the thing, like you must love doing this podcast. And like when I love doing music, it's easier to kind of get into it. But, you know, there's some days when you're not having a good day or like you've... Maybe you've had a disagreement with someone where you're just like, oh, please, no. But yeah, just I have one main task if I'm on a working day, I've got one main task, and if I can take that off, great. Anything else is just a bonus, but I have to do it like that. Otherwise, I feel like I've not been. Productive enough, but I've got like a, this is my toxic personality trait, I have to feel exhausted by the end of the day, really, mentally, otherwise I don't feel like I've done enough.
Really?
And that's not healthy.
No.
Now that I do this, like I've got this one main task, and if I take that off, great. It's better and a bit more controlled, because I used to just, I used to burn out like every 3 months and then have a few days of just can't process anything. And
where do you think that comes from then, like having to feel mentally exhausted, not physically and mentally, but mentally just like drained from?
Yeah, my dad's got the same thing.
Has he?
Yeah, so he's not a workaholic, but is, I guess we have had a lot of self-worth tied up in productivity, which nowadays, when there's a lot of conversation around that, you're like, oh, that's not healthy, so I should do it like this, and it's easier. But when he was younger, he just went absolutely hell for that, which is, you know, he had a fantastic career, so it has its pros and cons, doesn't it?
Does, yeah. And it's taken me a very, very long time to learn not to beat yourself up if you don't achieve what you want to achieve. And I have like that one thing each day, but below that, I'll have like five tasks, and one is like the starred one. And it's like, if you complete that one, then the rest of the day, you can take the rest of the day off. But if you want to carry on, work through those other ones.
Have you read Atomic Habits?
Yeah. James Clear. Try to get him on the podcast.
We might come on.
Yeah.
No, come on, James. Love to.
Yeah.
Come on.
Go on, James Clear.
that's a great book.
Mm.
I know that I need to be conscious in the way that I'm doing things, because tying yourself worth to your productivity level is obviously not healthy, but also, if I hadn't have done that in my early 20s, I definitely wouldn't be where I'm at either. Mm. So it's a balance, isn't it?
It is, if there is such a thing.
Mm. Still trying to find it.
Yeah. So look, let's talk a little bit about YouTube channel then. When did you start recording videos for YouTube, and was there a goal at the start, or was it literally just like, I want to put stuff out there and see what happens?
All I wanted was people to interact with the thing at the beginning. So I made a channel first called HET2810. That was my initials and date of birth. And I posted videos on there, which was my camera turned to the wall. So my face wasn't even on the camera. I think I was about 16 and I didn't want anyone to know I was doing it. Using my webcam. I remember getting my first comment, and it was just the most amazing feeling. And it was a woman who was in America. And then it was kind of like a light bulb moment, really, of, oh, I don't have a fan base here, but I could make one globally if I keep posting on this site. And at the time, YouTube, you walk down the street and say, do you know what YouTube is? And nobody would.
Yeah.
So it was relatively an unknown thing. And then I saw Boyce Avenue posting a lot of videos on there, and that spurred me on, I guess.
How long ago was that then? Was that, say, when did YouTube first start? 2009 or something like that? Was that right?
2006. Yeah.
Oh, well, okay.
2006.
Okay, interesting. And what was the process? It was just you, nobody else involved. You just with your camera recording yourself.
Yeah. So when I finally turned the camera around to face me, that would be a good start, wouldn't it? It was just a Packard Bell laptop.
Yeah.
And it was just the inbuilt mic, and I would just record. I would stand there with my acoustic guitar and just record a 2-minute version of a cover, and then post it. And it was it was really bad quality.
and you had that, and we all do that when we listen back to or look back at past stuff. How did you start getting traction then? So you got like the first comment that you saw, and I'm the same. You like that first feedback you get. You're like, there's somebody out there.
Yeah.
You know, there's somebody out there. How did that build? How did it go from, say, like one person commenting to then, I looked at like one of your videos has got 41 million bloody views or something.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's like nearly the population of the UK or something. It's just crazy, isn't it?
Oh my God, that's wild.
When it's like
it?
60 million people in the UK, right? It's
I haven't been able to visualise that before. Oh my God, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that video was posted, it must be maybe 7 years in. So I posted my first video, which was, I'm pretty sure it was Fast Car by Tracy Chapman. And then got that first comment and got another comment about 2 weeks later, and then posted another video. There was a similar, it might have been Iris by the Goo Goo Dolls, similar kind of feel, same chords. Then started getting a few more comments, but a few comments from the same people.
Okay.
So it was really started to become this, what I now realise is like the 1,000 true fans kind of theory.
Yeah, that community aspect.
Yeah, where like the same people were coming back, which is the whole premise of YouTube subscribers, isn't it? So at that time, when you subscribe to something online, you would see it when it got posted, but things have changed. yeah, so it was just the same people kept coming back, and then it got to a point around 2011. I don't think I'd got many videos up, but I posted a cover of Teenage Dream by Katy Perry, and that one did really well, and that's the one that the lead singer of Boyce Avenue saw. And then they invited me on tour, and then we started to collaborate and stuff. So it all kind of went from there.
And how did that growth escalate? What kind of a period of time did you go from, I don't know, 100 views a video to 1,000 to 100,000 to a million to...
Yeah, so...
How quickly or how slowly as people listening?
Really slow. Really slow.
Such thing as an overnight success.
No, God. And I used to get, like, I used to do... In the early period, when the videos started going more viral and they would hit like a million views, I would do like talks or panels where people would say, "So what should I?" As if there was a shortcut.
Yeah,
you know,
here's the silver bullet.
And there's not. There's really not, unless you've got loads of money to spend on paid ads. Yeah. There's just not. We've never run paid ads on the YouTube videos. So the first 3 years, I think it was the first 3 years, all the videos were getting between 60 and 250 views maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then between like year three and four, it was in the couple of thousands. And then I think before I started working with Boyce Avenue, the most the videos would get sort of within 1 week would be maybe 25,000. And then I started to collaborate with Boyce Avenue, and that cross-pollination, I mean, I say cross-pollination, but it was basically a lot just from their side.
Right.
I was doing the kind of music that their massive audience were already familiar with and liked.
Okay.
And when we started collaborating, a lot of their audience became my audience. And that was great. And so the views, you know, I was sort of doing like 25,000 regularly, and they shot up to the millions within 6 months.
Really?
Yeah. Thanks, Boyce Avenue. No, so that was a real turning point, definitely, yeah.
And what were you thinking at that point in time?
I was like, wow, I am a rock star.
I am Beyonce level.
it was, the numbers were wild, and it is hard to visualise even now. But I was just, because they're unique views, and so I just couldn't really compute, but I was like, this is amazing. It was already my career after, you know, like through uni, but when the videos started going really viral and things like YouTube AdSense money and all that kind of stuff and the streaming started coming, and I was like, this is actually my job. What an amazing job. Like, this is just incredible and better than I ever expected it to be, because, you know, usually, well, pre-internet, an artist had to really pay their dues a lot on the road, touring, and be very lucky and be working with a team of people that were very experienced, probably at a massive label, to get that kind of exposure.
Yeah.
And it was just happening, and I was just a girl sat in my bedroom looking at these views, like, what the hell's going on? But, yeah, it was just really exciting. It was great.
What I found easy is when to put it in your mind as like to how many people, when somebody said to me, and I was like looking at download numbers, and again, like how, you know, it evolved, and I go, yeah, but it's still not that many people. And somebody went, there's more people than go to watch Arsenal in their home stadium at the weekend against Man United. And you're like, okay, there's quite a lot of people in one place at the same time listening to me talking to somebody.
Yeah. And then also, it's like, I think when we look at views or streams or whatever, and we're thinking about the people, and we're like, oh, it's had 1,000 streams, so that's 1,000 people, and it doesn't feel like a lot. Mm. But then all of those people have like lives as complex as yours, and then it becomes really mind blowing if it's even one person.
Mm.
So I'm not even going to try and think about that for the biggest video that I've done, because that would blow my mind, have me done by today. So.
Go and take the rest of the day off.
Yeah.
And then signing with Boyce Avenue's recording label, how did that have an impact on your growth and your perspective, your vision?
Yeah, it was... So when I'd gone out to support them in London... We'd been talking about this proposed contract for a while, because they were looking to develop an artist and build something the way that we had been, both separately through covers, and I ended up signing this contract after a lot of to and fro. And we started working together, but it was very much like they gave me a lot of tips from a musician standpoint, from just tiny things really, but that make a massive difference. Like now if I'm finger picking and then I go to strumming, Alejandro's got this technique where he holds a plectrum between his two joints of his finger, and tiny things like that make a big difference to things on stage, and like the way to hold yourself on stage, and things to do between songs, and arrangements of songs, and how to kind of carry the journey of a song. So we were doing this all with covers, but then it really sparked a fire in me to write original songs. And because I'd learned so much about these hit songs, I found myself writing songs that it just felt easy. Mm-hmm. I think because I'd subconsciously been studying these hit songs, that I kind of fell in love with songwriting and arrangements of songs and things like that. And then I really wanted to focus on that. And that's where we ended up parting ways at that point, because I still love doing covers, but I needed to get more original music out of my system.
Mm-hmm.
And our working arrangement was based around the covers, really.
Okay.
So I couldn't do that so much if I continued to do covers on the schedule that we were on at that time. And they were really good about it, and they said, cool. And they didn't have to be, you know. They could have been like, you're staying, but they were just like going, you know. They did the original artist albums before, and they still write original music, and they know that it's like a fulfilling thing to do as a creative artist. So I think they'd had... experiences with labels before those deals were very hard to get out of, and I think so they were very open to helping me do whatever I wanted to do, which was amazing.
And what was it like getting like a number one in a country? I mean, for somebody who's like initially in their bedroom in Leeds, to then being told that you got like a number one song in Vietnam.
So I was on Twitter and I was just talking. I was just doing some. They used to call it Twitter storms, where someone would be on Twitter just basically tweeting a load of rubbish one after the other. And now it's like threads, isn't it? Twitter threads, where it's like six tweets in one, and it's, if you want to learn how to do this, you're going to like the tweet below. So I was on Twitter talking to a few people, and then somebody from the Philippines said, your song's number one in Vietnam. And I was like, wow, no way. So then at the time there was this thing, this website online called Whale Report, and it's not accessible now, which is a real shame, because it used to be the way that I tracked all of the chart positions for the covers and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it was number one in Vietnam and Laos, so I was just kind of
another mind-blowing
blown away.
Moment.
And that someone on Twitter told me as well. I thought I would find out some other way, but
power of social media. I always think, you know, the power of YouTube, the power of Apple, Spotify, etc. Years ago, you never would have been able to reach people in those countries without, again, taking like massive paid advertising campaigns to reach those kind of people. Because it would have just been monopolised by those big artists, big labels who had the budget to promote their artists.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think my style of music as well was very popular over there, which helped a lot for the song. But when that song came out, the singer-songwriter thing at the time was having a bit of a lull in the UK. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, well, how do I find the people, or where's my fan base? And it just happened that they're not primarily in this country. So, you know, the majority of people who listen to my music now, and I think it's in the 70%, are from Southeast Asia.
Interesting.
And then a lot of people from Brazil, and then it gets to like the US and the UK and Germany and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, so if I want to get absolutely smashed and go to the shop to get a pint of milk looking like I've been dragged through a bush backwards, then I can do that here. And then that's great.
And what have been, what's the most challenging part of what you do, do you think?
In my 20s, maybe 10 years ago, I was very affected by negative comments. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the most challenging part of it for me. And then maybe slightly before that, when I was figuring out the different revenue streams, cash flow was hard.
Yeah.
And kind of like envisaging a way to get out of that when that was a bit tricky. And now, I think I was speaking to Jack Conti, who's the CEO of Patreon, about this, and he was saying that one of the things that comes up a lot for artists like me, where there are different streams of revenue and different interests, actually, is just that the hardest thing is to define what we are. Mm-hmm. To somebody. Like I find it very difficult to give somebody an elevator pitch of who I am.
Right, okay.
And some people who work with me just on the digital marketing side are like, Hannah used to be an artist, but I didn't used to be. So it's very hard to, and for my own sanity, I guess, it's just a bit difficult to have a firm identity when you've got this artist identity and you're still doing that alongside other stuff, and then all of a sudden you're writing a book. It's just like, what
do you compartmentalize?
Okay. I have to a bit. I have to. I don't I think some of the things as well, I'm like, do they even fit together? But it must do if it's my life, mustn't it? So,
indeed. Yeah. Yeah. And do you ever doubt the path that you're on? You're saying it's difficult to kind of put what you do into an elevator pitch, but do you have any more doubts on any of those kind of aspects that you do? Are you super confident? Book, agency, music, tunnel vision.
I think I'm very open to other things, and I'm very... One of my problems is that I feel like... This might come across so badly, but I feel like I could do anything. And part of that is because of the internet. Because some of the stuff that I've learned online, you know, like all the videos that I've shot and edited, it's just been learned through YouTube, all of that stuff. All the songs that I've learned to play through YouTube and ultimateguitar.com, all the stuff about business I've learned through books and videos. And so I'm just like now building this agency and also having built a sustainable independent career in music, which is very difficult, but I've been able to do it. I'm just like I was listening to someone kind of in my earwig and to someone's conversation the other day about they were starting this they were going to become a middleman between tradesmen and people who needed it, and so they'd set up this website and they were, yes, we can do that, and then getting on the phone to some, and I was just like, well, anyone can I could do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's obviously a few things that I can't do. Like, I couldn't be like a brain surgeon. Well, but if I studied to be, I'm like, so I feel like just because of the wealth of knowledge now and the access, the ease of access to it, I feel like I don't really have any doubts about being able to do something. Because if I can't do it, then I'll just learn how to do it.
That's a great mindset. I mean, does that come from your dad, from your parents? Or something you've just built up?
Maybe. I mean, me and my sister were always sort of, we were brought up to work hard and to know the value of money and to value time. And so that maybe it's a bit of that. I think a lot of it has also kind of come from, I don't know what I'm doing or how I'm going to do this, so I need to figure it out bloody quickly.
Yeah.
Which happened a lot with music and with content creation in the beginning, because I was just, how the hell am I going to do this and also be able to pay my bills and also make enough content that people see me? I need to figure it out fast. And so.
And when it came to Back Pocket Club, your agency then, where did the idea for that come from? Was that like a screw it, just do it moment that just kind of changed the path that you were on?
Yeah, pretty much. So my business partner Nath, he'd been working agency side for a few years and wasn't happy where he was, and I'd been doing some digital marketing bits for other people but a lot for myself for many years, and I think we were having a burrito. And like we just had a catch up and had a burrito. And I was just like, should we just start an agency? And I think like lockdown had just finished, and I was just like, should we just do it? And he was like, yeah, all right. So we just did it.
And you haven't looked back.
No.
Love it. I'm writing a book. Again, when did you decide to do it, and why now? Why 2023?
So my publisher, the commissioning editor of Taylor & Francis or Rutledge, got in touch with me pre-lockdown, so it must have been 2019, maybe 2020. And I was teaching music business at Leeds Conservatoire at that time, and I think some publishers go, especially educational publishers, go through university staff lists and kind of see who's there and what kind of story they've got going on. And I think my Busker to 300 million streams thing caught her eye, and especially with it being independent, and she sort of reached out and we went for coffee and she said, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I said, no. well, it just wasn't on my radar at all, actually. And so she gave me some information about what it would look like and I started to think about it more. And then I started producing Backstage Pass podcasts for Tom and over lockdown. And my ideas around what the book should be like kind of started coming together at the same time when I was reading a lot of other business books. And then I just got back in touch with her and said, I think it should be like this, and kind of gave her I plan stuff, but previously I didn't. Gave her a really detailed plan of what it would be like, and we just went from there, really.
And any advice you'd give to other young aspiring like independent artists, knowing what you know now, having run an agency, having written a book?
Yeah, I would just say I got on YouTube at a very good time. It was new. It wasn't super duper new, but it was new enough that you would be able to see my videos because they were still pushing them out to the people who wanted to see them. Mm. So if I was an artist right now, I would focus my efforts on where the most eyes are or the newest platforms. So a couple of years ago, I would have said TikTok. I would still maybe focus on TikTok, but maybe have a look to see what else is coming up, because sometimes there's little waves of activity on an app that doesn't skyrocket in the end, but has a little bit of something. And I would try and just have a presence on something that is growing or is in like an early stage of what it could be, because that's where YouTube was at when I was on it, and I do think at that time and helped a lot. But I would also say multiple streams of revenue, definitely. Try and figure out what streams of revenue work for what you're doing and how much time you can dedicate to those. And it might not be an even split, but how can you sustainably create revenue streams that are going to help support you do the thing that you want to do. That's what I would say, because I think a lot of artists now that everybody's thinking about content and everything's content, it's like a lot of artists will make a lot of content, put it on a social media site, it might do a little bit of something, it might even go viral, but then if they're not constantly getting viral videos or they're not making money from what they're doing, they end up quitting way too soon. And it's perseverance, but it's also not putting all your eggs in one basket. And I think sometimes people put all their eggs in one basket. Like, even with YouTube, I didn't put all my eggs in one basket. I was still busking and playing at weddings and trying to tour. And so yeah, multiple streams of revenue. Have a plan if you can, and just persevere. And also, you know, it feels great to be able to say I'm a full-time musician, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And if you focus on being a full-time musician to the point where you're skint, it's just unsustainable. So if you need to get a job to support your music, do that.
Yeah, don't be too proud
So yeah, that's what I would say. Go out and busk.
Go out and busk. No, and I agree with you with the multiple streams of income, and I think the pandemic showed us that more than ever.
Yeah.
Even if you're like a massive brand and you literally had no online presence, it was just, you know, like, shit, people can't buy our stuff anymore.
Yeah, totally, yeah. That was a real kicker. And a lot of my friends have had to completely retrain. Like, my guitarist is now a physiotherapist, and he loves it and he's really good at it, but nobody saw that coming.
No.
Yeah, a lot of people that I knew who worked in music had to retrain, and some of them have gone back to music and some of them haven't. So, yeah, tricky one.
Interesting. And any, when you kind of look back then, any key turning points on that path from, you know, 17 year old you busking, taking that year out, going to university,
yeah,
touring, starting up an agency, writing a book, any kind of look in the rearview mirror, any like major turning points, any moments? Kind of pinnacle moments, I guess, where that changed the course.
Yeah, I think committing to a schedule of putting X amount of things out every week was a big turning point, because it's like you say, like even if you don't feel like it, you still have to show up.
It's a habit, then, isn't it? It's a James Clear.
So yeah, it's an atomic habit. It works, people. it does work. It's consistency, really. The consistency of it on the cover side was the turning point.
People don't want to hear that, do they? But
no, and it's consistency for a long time as well. It's that was a real turning point. And then I think, honestly, it just helps being a bit older and having a bit more life experience. Like now when I make decisions, they're a little less based on emotion. And so things that are happening now in my life are seem to be happening in the way that I want them to happen faster, probably because I'm able to think about it in a more rational way. Mm. And make decisions that are informed or like considered in like a logical way rather than just, oh, but this is how it makes me feel kind of thing.
Yeah. And are you where you wanted to be? That original vision where you saw yourself heading into the music industry and that first initial kind of plan, vision that you have, would you say you are where you wanted to be, or have the goalposts shifted? Back Pocket Club, book.
Yeah, when I started making music when I was like 7, I wanted to be the next Britney Spears. So I'm not where I wanted to be, but I figured out along the way that I didn't want to be there, which was really important. And if I had got that life, I don't think I would be happy.
Would you want to be where Britney Spears is now? No, is the question.
Nope. No, thanks.
No, I don't think Britney does either, does she?
maybe that's a tricky example. Superstardom is what I thought I wanted, and it's not what I want as an adult.
It's a good answer.
Probably shouldn't have come on this podcast because.
And what learnings can you take from to help you tackle the next chapter of your life based on what's happened in the past, do you think?
I think the main thing that's held me back in my career is taking too long to make hard decisions. So there's been a few situations where I know that I've needed to end a business relationship and I've not done it because I didn't want to hurt someone or I've had a gut feeling about a certain direction of music or a certain thing, even down to little things like the artwork or the title of something, where I've not gone with my gut and then wished I had. And I think it's just that kind of going with my gut more and having hard conversations as soon as feasibly possible and making decisions on things that I know need resolving or need changing sooner rather than putting them off. But I just had too much nervous energy to do that when I was like 22. I just couldn't. I felt like if I broke off a business relationship that it would be the end of everything.
Totally relate to that. Yeah.
And there were a lot of things that were almost like safety nets through my career that I just was too scared to let go of. And it's not like now I'm more brutal and I'm like, you're fired. But I just, Yeah.
But it's often making a decision, isn't it? Making a decision is better than making no decisions, just kicking the can down the road.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah.
And if, knowing what you now know, and thinking of that girl in her bedroom, what advice would you give to her? Don't be Britney Spears.
I think I just... if I could say something to myself, I would just say, like, you're good at what you do, and it's okay. And some people actually aren't going to like the music, and that's fine. Like, there's music that I don't like, and I don't think... well, I hope those bands or artists don't give a shit that I don't like it. You know what I mean?
Make it for yourself.
Yeah, like, make it for yourself and try and be as present as possible in the moment, because when I was younger, or when I did think that I wanted this like ultimate level of fame, my head was always 5 or 10 years in the future, and I wasn't like enjoying the moment for some of the things that I've done, and I wish that I had have been. So now when I'm going out on tour at the end of this month, I'm just like, I'm going to be so in it.
Amazing. How long are you on tour for?
Not long, just a week around the UK. And I'm just, because of everything that's come before and because it's my first tour since we weren't able to tour, I'm just like very consciously going to be present and doing it in the way that I wish I had have done it 10 years ago.
Awesome. I read a couple of quotes where you said to focus on the journey.
Yeah.
And another one, to choose happiness.
Yes. Where's that from?
I read a couple of articles. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, because I think people would... because I totally agree with both of those, and I constantly have to remind myself of the first part, like, just focus on the journey, not the destination.
Yeah.
And it's probably only recently, the last year or so, that I'm more motivated by just do what makes you happy, and casting my mind back to what used to light me up as a kid or a young adult, and just going, what do you actually love doing? And then realising, last time I did that was 2 years ago. You know, or, you know, like me, simple things like, what do you love? I love being on a snowboard, you know, snowboarding in powder. I love going on a trip with my friends from uni and stuff. Don't do any of those things, Alex. So how can you make those happen? Because that's what makes you happy.
Yeah.
And again, doing podcast interviews in person, not doing them in a 2D on a Zoom call, it's like, that's what I used to do pre-pandemic and that's what I love. Well, start bloody doing it again, you know. Yeah. How about for yourself?
I'm just aware that we're all going to die very soon in the grand scheme of things. So the choose happiness thing is just... I think it would be really sad if I or somebody else didn't choose what's going to make them happy, and because it would just be a wasted life, I think. So choose happiness is kind of maybe for myself, but I think that's what I would say to other people if they wanted any advice. the other one, focus on the journey, is something I can say now, because of not focusing on the journey. And just, you know, a lot of artists, and including myself, get quite caught up in this idea of making it, which I think just needs to be reframed into making it happen, and just love something that kind of is a happening, continuing thing in the moment, and different things are happening, great, but you're in it and living it, and not thinking so much about, I wish I was there, or that person's up here and I'm here. But there's been a journey for them as well.
I think it's really valuable advice what you've given, and it's a super interesting journey that you have, because you're saying there are other ways to be successful and be happy in what you do, and it's not the be all and end all to just focus in on this one thing and the destination of that, but you've shown that you can, you know, embrace other outlets to and make it your thing, make it part of you. And I think that's only going to increase as time goes by. I mean, the amount of iterations that I've had, you know, reinvented myself a number of times, and I think that's only going to happen more as more jobs become obsolete and new jobs become invented. Yeah. It's keeping your eyes and ears open to opportunities that are out there, and again, doing what lights you up.
AI is going to kill us all, isn't it?
We had a podcast about that.
Really? I have to listen to that one.
With Piers Lenny, yeah, former Dragon's Den investor who's now started an AI company.
Oh, no.
last question, or two questions I would ask is, first of all, people listen to this podcast who want to listen to your music, want you to help them through your agency. Easiest places to get hold of you?
To get hold of me, probably Twitter.
X.
If not, yeah. Oh God, X. I mean, if they're gonna change it to X, they need to start. Surely the whole thing needs to say X, because it's like it still says tweets. So yeah. It still says yup. Anyway,
he hasn't thought it through.
Whatever. Twitter blue. Like I don't. Yeah. X. I'm really bad with Insta DMs. Don't Insta DM me, because you'll never hear from me ever. There's an email address on my website, which is hannahtrigwell.com, and there's an email address on backpocketclub.com. Perfect. Either of them, yeah, I'm super easy to get hold of through them.
Amazing. Hannah Trigo, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for watching this episode of Screw It, Just Do It. Let me know what you thought of it in the comments below this video. Has this episode helped move you closer to where you want to be? All that I ask is that if you enjoyed this episode and that it's moved you closer to getting to where you want to be, that you share this episode so that it helps one other person do just the same. Just ask yourself what small action will move you forward to get you from where you are, then screw it and just do it. Until next time.